This is Liz Siegert, one of the co-producers of HealthCetera. Prescription drugs are a $425 billion business in the United States, and growing. And a good chunk of that goes to medication for chronic pain. The National Institutes of Health says more than 25 million of us report having daily pain, and 23 million are in a lot of pain. So about 1 in 5 of us are prescribed opioids to manage it. Now, we all know about the high rate of substance use disorder in the U.S., and while opioids certainly have their place, especially for acute pain, they're not necessarily an ideal long-term option. So what else can we do to help people with persistent pain? I spoke with one health expert who says we should look at alternative and complementary options, and that by integrating different approaches into a person-centered health plan, we can significantly reduce our national dependence on prescription drugs. I'd like to welcome Dr. Wayne Jonas, a practicing family physician and former head of the National Institute of Health Office of Alternative Medicine. Dr. Jonas has just written a new book called How Healing Works, which looks at how we might take some of the practices he's been involved with and use them to tackle some of the nation's biggest health crises. Welcome, Dr. Jonas.
Thank you, Liz. It's great to be here.
So why don't we start by explaining the differences between complementary and alternative medicine versus what we would think of as traditional or Western medicine?
Yeah, so traditional Western medicine is what I'm trained in and what I've practiced all my life in the military and outside. And it basically is a science-based approach that largely uses sort of pills and procedures for managing disease. And it's very good at keeping people alive, at treating acute disease, infections, and managing, you know, flare-ups of chronic illness, like if you have a heart attack or a stroke and sort of jumping on those. And we're extremely good at that. We're not so good at managing the chronic disease, however, which is the largest part of what people suffer as they get older, especially. And especially in the prevention and sort of reversal of that. And so this book is about how do we widen our lens to focus on the determinants of health. And now the definitions that you've just asked about, alternative is things that are not practiced by the conventional doc. These are things I did not learn in medical school. Complementary are those things that are used together with what I learned in medical school, so you'd use them alongside. But the term that I think is really the future of healthcare and the way I recommend good healthcare go is integrative. And integrative is the intersection between conventional pills and procedure type of medicine with lifestyle and health behavior, such as nutrition, activity, sleep, stress management, as well as evidence-based complementary or alternative practices, such as acupuncture, yoga, and supplements.
We can all remember a time when insurers wouldn't cover things like acupuncture or massage. They just thought it was a little bit off the rails. Are you finding more or less skepticism among your colleagues, your peers, and your patients?
Well, there is a growing not only acceptance, but attempts at incorporation and the creation of integrative health, this kind of overlapping of conventional, complementary, and lifestyle and behavior. And that's growing tremendously because we realize now that it's actually what gets at the best way of managing chronic illness. For example, there is a growth of acupuncture in the Defense Department. The Veterans Administration is about to open up centers for integrative health around all around the country. And there are over 70 academic medical centers. These are research centers with medical schools that have integrative centers that are delivering that. I was just up at one at Thomas Jefferson, University of California. Irvine is about to create an entire four health college school oriented around integrative health. So this is growing. The recognition of its value is growing, and the implementation of it is also growing around the country.
One of the things I found interesting in your book was you mentioned that a person is an ecosystem. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, our modern medical system tends to treat us almost mechanically, sort of like we're cars. You know, we look at taking organs and joints in and out. We look at changing the anatomy. We look at trying to alter the biochemistry. But the body and the person is much more complicated than that. I mean, a whole person involves not only those physical components, but they involve the interaction with the environment constantly. They are a social body. You can't really be a whole person without the relationships around you and being embedded in a community. And we also have a mind, aspirations, a spiritual components. And so really mind, body, spirit, and all these aspects interact with each other to make up what's valuable in life and what, you know, people are here for, what they enjoy, what matters to them. And so to really create health and well-being, one has to pay attention to all of those, not simply, you know, look at manipulating the mechanical part of the body.
So you talk a little bit about the differences between healing and curing. What's that?
So curing is going in and trying to fix something. It is taking this framework, this mechanical type of framework that I just described. It's looking for a disease, trying to find a single cause if possible, and then going in and trying to eliminate that. And that's what I learned in medical school. In fact, we have textbooks about that. It's called pathogenesis for those who are interested in the medical term. Pathogenesis means genesis, the creation of pathology, disease. Healing is the flip side of that, and it's going on in you all the time. And I use the term salutogenesis, which I didn't coin. It was coined by a guy by the name of Antonovsky back in the 70s and 80s. But saluto means health, and genesis means the creation of health. So by focusing on creation of health, that is the process of healing. We can actually mitigate and prevent a lot of chronic illnesses.
What are some of the things that affect healing? You mentioned a few things already, mind and spirit and relationships. What else goes into that mix?
Well, I think most people, most of your listeners know already, because they hear about it all the time, about how lifestyle is important. So, and we're getting more and more information about this every single day, and the science is extremely solid. You know, how you move and exercise, what your diet is like, how much sleep you get, the stress you're under, and how well you are at how resilient you are in terms of managing that stress, what skills you have. These things have a huge impact. In fact, they have a bigger impact in many cases than the drugs that we use to try to manage many of the chronic diseases like diabetes, obesity, hypertension, et cetera. And so lifestyle and behavior is important. We don't have a system, however, that implements that in the clinical setting. Your doctor says, well, you should get more exercise or you should eat better, et cetera, but they don't actually know how to deliver it. So we actually have to bring other folks in, and you have to learn how to do that yourself to assist in that.
Mm-hmm.
I think a second very important area is the social environment. Loneliness is an epidemic. We don't hear much about it. But the data shows that, for example, an individual after a heart attack, if they are isolated and alone and they feel lonely, that is as much of a risk factor for them having another heart attack as smoking a pack a day. Your doctor will tell you don't smoke, right, after you have a heart attack, but very rarely will they ask you, you know, what's your love life like?
Right. I don't know that I've ever been asked that by a doctor.
Exactly. This is the point of the book, is that we're trying to get doctors and patients to say, these are the underlying determinants of health, so we need to start asking these questions in the day-to-day medical encounter.
Do we have some evidence-based studies to confirm all the ideas that you're putting forth here?
Well, a lot of the lifestyle things are very well supported with lots of evidence. In the area of complementary practices, for example, acupuncture, yoga, massage, there's growing evidence for these, although it's not full by any means. But particularly in the area of pain, there's growing evidence that these kinds of practices, these non-pharmacological approaches to pain, are important, and there is evidence for it. In fact, the American College of Physicians, the Center for Disease Control, CDC, and the FDA have all recommended that we need to use more non-pharmacological approaches for pain management in order to try to mitigate the opioid epidemic that everybody hears about. And, you know, the opioid epidemic is an example of how we've gone way too far on the just more pills side. Treating pain with opioids has created chronic pain, especially. It's very important for and works very well for acute pain. But for chronic pain, it's not a good idea. But we can't simply remove the opioids because if people are on them, they need other approaches. And so some of these approaches, like acupuncture, like yoga, like massage therapy, have been demonstrated in good randomized controlled trials to be effective, and they're being recommended now by guidelines to be put in. Doctors need to figure out how to do that, and patients need to ask about them.
Do we have the resources to put behind these efforts? I mean, medical schools are not teaching this.
You know, this is one of the reasons that the University of California, Irvine, decided to go ahead and frame its entire educational system, nursing, medical, pharmacy, public health school, around this area, because there is a gap in which these areas are not being taught. And the Academic Consortium for Integrative Medicine is attempting to do that. So, yes, we need much more emphasis on that in medical education. I teach in a medical school. I teach residents. And I can tell you young physicians are hungry for how do you do this? How do you open up and begin to address the causes of health, the determinants of health, and bring it into your practice? So, yes, we need to put much more emphasis on things like nutrition and non-pharmacological approaches to pain.
Do you find that there's any difference in how physicians, as opposed to other health professionals like nurses, might manage patients' pain in terms of integrating the whole person as opposed to treating the specific acute problem?
I think, yes, there definitely is. Nurses and physicians have different roles in healthcare delivery. And I think they also look at the patient differently because they're providing different kind of services. The physicians tend to look at, the scores and the ranking, you know, how much pain do you have? And they tend to use tools like medications and procedures, injections and things like that. Those are the tools that they've been trained in that they have. Nurses know that the social environment, for example, and they know that movement, they know that empathy, connecting with individuals, they know that the expectations and beliefs of patients are very important in how well they feel and how well they do. And so they have a major role in providing those kinds of what are often called softer aspects, but the evidence shows are very, very important.
So is it mind over matter, or is it something that goes deeper than that?
Well, the mind is a very important, and belief and expectancies are very important. But it isn't just what you think. It isn't just thinking yourself well. That's not what I'm talking about here. This is much deeper than that. This is about our social expectations, the rituals. It's about the behaviors that condition our body to behave in certain ways. It's about how our physiology learns how to respond in our social and mental environment and through our behaviors. And so it's not simply thinking that, well, if I just am optimistic, I'm going to be well. That's not it. It is really about delivering a whole person empathetic care as a culture and doing it in a way that that alters the physiology and actually produces hard outcomes.
And how can our listeners find out more about this? Your book just was published yesterday, I believe.
Well, I try to tell this in a concrete way through patient experiences and patients I've seen. And then I back that up with research. So I go back and forth between the data and the actual patient stories. And at the end of the book, I try to say, what's next? How do you make this available in your own life? And so in the back of the book, I have a chapter that's specifically focused to help patients do this in their own life. And then there's a chapter about how you do it with your doctor. And there's one for your doctor. So I recommend patients actually give their doctor a part of the book and ask them to do something that I call a healing-oriented practice of environment visit, a hope note, or it's an integrative health visit that any doctor can do. They don't have to be a specialist in these areas, but they need to organize the questions around what we know delivers the 80% of what manages and prevents chronic illness. And on my website, drwaynejonas.com, we are supplementing this with demonstrated research-based tools that can assist both the patients and doctors further in delivering this kind of whole person care.
We've been speaking with Dr. Wayne Jonas. He's the former head of the NIH Office of Alternative Medicine and the author of How Healing Works. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.
For HealthCetera, I'm Liz Siegert.